Thank you very much. It's such a great pleasure to be here. I've watched so many Religious Liberty Weekends at the Village Church here. I love the programs, so I'm absolutely thrilled to be here speaking. So let's talk about critical thinking, basic skills for life. So as Dr. Vine mentioned, I am an attorney, a licensed attorney, and I practiced for 19 years before starting my own business. And, you know, I've been asked, why did you decide to be an attorney? And I have to say, my parents taught me how to think critically. And every Sabbath, you know, I grew up Seventh-day Adventist, although I was out of the church for many years. When I grew up Seventh-day Adventist, my father and I would spend afternoons talking about what the pastor spoke about. So we debated religion, philosophy, you know, the things that were happening during, you know, our time back then. And he really caused me to think about things and asked probing questions and taught me how to think critically, and we debate back and forth. So it was that give and take and exchange of debate that really lit my fire for being a lawyer and really made me want to go to law school. So I thank him for that. And so this is my ministry, Revelation 13, 17, cbdcwatch.substack.com. As Dr. Vine said, I came back to the church during the pandemic because I saw prophecy unfolding before our eyes, and I monitor the central banks, and I can see what they're doing when they really, during the pandemic, started ramping up on the CBDC thing, central bank digital currency, and it is the perfect instrument of enforcement, of control, that the beasts would want. I mean, this is the tool that the two beasts of Revelation could possibly want. This is it. That no man might buy or sell. How could they do that? It's through CBDCs, and that's what we'll talk about tomorrow. So let's talk about wisdom and reason. God wants to reason with us, and he tells us that in the scriptures. Isaiah 1:18, come now and let us reason together. And in 2 Timothy 1:7, for God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. God wants to reason with us, and he wants us to have a sound mind. And Job said in Job 13:3, surely I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God. So we do want to reason with God, and he wants to reason with us. And God wants us to have wisdom. Proverbs 4, 5 through 7 says, get wisdom, get understanding, forget it not, neither decline from the words of my mouth. Forsake her not, meaning wisdom, and she shall preserve thee. Love her, and she shall keep thee. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get understanding. So what are the characteristics of a critical thinker? A critical thinker values clarity and precision, is sensitive to thinking errors, is intellectually honest, which is very important. You don't see a lot of that these days, unfortunately. A critical thinker welcomes criticism of beliefs and is open to revising beliefs on the presentment of facts, thinks independently, and also strives to know the truth. So let's talk about the need for critical thinking skills. Critical thinking skills are essential and really play a crucial role in various aspects of personal, academic, and professional life. And let's talk about some reasons why critical thinking skills are important. Problem solving. With critical thinking skills, it helps us analyze problems, identify possible solutions, and make informed decisions. Decision making. Critical thinking allows us to access information, weigh different options, and make well-reasoned decisions. And it helps us with effective communication. Critical thinkers can articulate their thoughts clearly and persuasively. They can express ideas, listen actively, engage in constructive dialogue, and foster better communication in various settings. And analyzing information, this is crucially important in critical thinking. Critical thinking gives us the ability to evaluate credibility and relevance of information. It enables us to distinguish between fact and opinion, identify biases, and make sense of data. Learning and adaptation. Critical thinking involves questioning assumptions, seeking evidence, and being open to new ideas, which is very important. And this adaptability is essential in a rapidly changing world. Career success. Employers value critical thinking skills because they contribute to problem solving, innovation, and effective decision making in the workplace. And individuals with strong critical thinking skills are often better equipped for leadership roles. So it's really important to be a good critical thinker. So we'll examine how we can do that. Skill building our critical thinking. Critical thinking is not our natural or default way of thinking, but it's something that we can all get better at. It's kind of like a muscle. The more you work that muscle, you start to look at things differently and really probe, why are the reasons they're saying this? Is there any evidence to support this? So some key critical thinking questions that we can use when we want to find out if a claim or representation is really true, when we're trying to validate the accuracy of information. Is there any evidence to support the argument? What evidence, if any, is presented to support the argument, and is it valid? Is X a credible source? Is the claim or argument biased, and what biases, if any, are present or are expressed? What assumptions are being made? Assumptions are things that are accepted as true without proof. So that's a problem right there, and often thinking problems hide where assumptions are buried. So we want to uncover all assumptions. When you're evaluating, when you're validating the accuracy of information, we want to also ask, are insights coming from the wisest points of view? Thinking problems lurk when we ignore the impact of perspective, including our own, and we want to consider where points of view might be too narrow, misguided, or even missing altogether. How strongly is the reasoning supported by relevant information? And we want to determine what information would be most relevant. What are the questions we should be asking based on what information would be most relevant? And we want to challenge conclusions. So there's two necessary conditions for critical thinking. One is you have to have the ability to change your mind on the presentment of facts. Good facts, solid facts that you can back up. The second condition is reflective skepticism, and this is something that was introduced by John McPeck in 1981. It involves requiring the person to know something about the topic under review and be able to ask meaningful and relatable questions about it. There's some questions that we can use to engage our critical thinking and embrace reflective skepticism. We have 10 types of questions we can ask. Number one, is this a fact? Number two, how relevant is this information, claim, or reason? Number three, is this statement factually accurate? Is the source credible? Are these claims or arguments ambiguous? What assumptions are being made, and what assumptions can we uncover? That's really crucially important. Is there bias, or what bias can we detect? Are there logical fallacies? Are there inconsistencies in the line of reasoning? And how strong is this argument or claim? So a good framework for analysis when we're analyzing a text or an article or a piece that's given to us, number one, we want to identify the line of reasoning in the text. What argument is it making? What point of view is it expressing? Two, we want to critically evaluate the line of reasoning. Does it contain relevant, contributing, and sufficient propositions or reasons? Does it contain logical progression? Or, on the flip side, does it contain false premises, or does it contain flawed reasoning? Number three, we want to question appearances on the surface and check for hidden assumptions or agendas. Is the evidence what it appears to be? Might there be other explanations apart from the obvious one? Has all necessary information been given, or might other details lead to a different conclusion? Are there interested parties who would receive a gain if the conclusions were accepted? That would indicate bias. And are there hidden assumptions or agendas? Does the evidence come from a reliable, unbiased, and disinterested source? Also, we want to identify evidence presented and evaluate it according to valid criteria. What is the source? Again, is there bias? And what is the sample size? Like, if it's a scientific article or a study, what is the sample size? How many people did they study? Is the sample size too small to draw a conclusion? And we should be aware of statistics given, percentages used, or the use of most or many. Many times when you see that, you want to take a look at the data that they use. Are they making an appropriate estimation when they use most or many, or when they apply certain percentage? Can that be mathematically duplicated? And were the conditions of the data collection appropriate or proper? Is there emotional language or persuasive language used? Many times on the news, when they want to instill fear in you, they'll use scary music or very persuasive language. So that's something else you can be aware of. We want to identify the writer's conclusions. Are they fair? Are they valid? Are there fallacies to identify? Are there inadequacies, a lack of evidence to support the conclusion, or a lack of plausibility? We want to decide whether the evidence given supports these conclusions. So let's go over some common logical fallacies. The straw man argument. One type of logical fallacy is the straw man argument. In this fallacy, a person sets up a distorted, extreme, or completely illogical assertion about the topic so they can attack this assertion rather than the actual issue at hand. So let's look at how this is done. The logical form is person one claims A, person two restates person one's claim in a way that completely misrepresents it in an adulterated way, and then attacks the misrepresented version, and therefore says claim A is false. So an example of this is person A says, I think it's important to invest more money in public schools to improve the educational system. Or not even money. I think it's important to invest more in public schools to improve the education system. The implication is you would invest money. But the straw man argument, person B says, so you're saying we should just throw unlimited money at the failing schools without any accountability. That's ridiculous. Well, that's not really what the first person said. In this example, person B has distorted person A's original argument. Person A never mentioned throwing unlimited amounts of money without accountability. The straw man argument misrepresents person A's position, making it easier for person B to attack a point that was never made. And it's important to note that addressing the actual argument, investing in public schools, would lead to a more meaningful and constructive discussion. You know, there's many different ways we could come at that issue, and to just create something that was completely not said, completely way off the mark, just to attack that because you don't want to deal with a real argument. That's often the times when you see a straw man argument. So how should we respond to a straw man argument? We should point out, I think this is, the first is the best way to respond to a straw man argument. Point out the straw man. Explain why their argument is fallacious and how it distorts your original stance. You can put them on the defensive in this way by asking them to justify why they believe the distorted stance that they present is the same one that you originally proposed. It's often very different. So your opponent will either be forced to admit that their argument was invalid, or they'll try to justify it by using even more fallacious reasoning, which you can then attack. So I think that's the best, most direct way to deal with the straw man argument. The second course you could take is you could ignore the straw man. You can just choose to ignore the distorted version of your argument that your opponent presents and continue to advocate for your original position. Or the third is that you could accept the straw man when defending your stance, meaning that instead of arguing in favor of your original stance, you start defending the distorted version of your stance as presented by your opponent. But keep in mind that the longer you go down this road, it's really hard to get back to the original argument. It's really hard, it's more difficult than to go back and point out your opponent's fallacious reasoning because you've kind of accepted it at that point. By defending the argument presented in the straw man, you appear to accept it as your own stance. So it's very difficult to go back then. But there are some circumstances when you might want to do that. Another common logical fallacy is circular reasoning. Circular reasoning is also known as begging the question. It occurs when the conclusion of an argument is already assumed in one of the premises. Essentially, the argument goes in a circle with one conclusion restating one of the premises in a slightly different form. So So let's look at an example of this. Circular reasoning is considered a logical fallacy because it doesn't offer any real evidence or reasoning to support the conclusion. The argument is circular because it relies on assuming the truth of what you're trying to prove. So an example would be, I'm always right because I never make mistakes. And then I never make mistakes because I'm always right. You would really need some real evidence to support that, or you'd be best served if there were real evidence to support that assertion, not just restating it a different way. Here the person is using circular reasoning to support the claim that he or she is always right. And the reasoning in both statements is essentially the same, with no external evidence or independent criteria provided to support the assertion of always being right. It's a circular argument because the conclusion relies on the assumption that the person is always right, which is really the very claim they're trying to establish. So that's why it's problematic when you encounter this. So how should we respond to circular reasoning? You could first point out that the problematic premise in their argument is the equivalent to or depends on their argument's conclusion. You could explain why this type of fallacious reasoning is flawed. You could ask the person who made the argument to explain how the problematic premise is different from the conclusion or how it stands on its own. You can ask the person who made the argument to provide separate evidence that their problematic premise is true without relying on the conclusion of the argument. I think that's really the best way to deal with circular reasoning. You really need to pin down the person and say, what do you have to support this other than just restating it? The next logical fallacy is the ad hominem attack, attack the man. It's also called attack the man. Ad hominem criticism is found when, instead of criticizing the argument or the ideas of the person that whom you're conversing, you criticize the person himself, and in so doing, you claim you have also criticized their argument. Ad hominem criticisms aren't always fallacious, but frequently they are fallacious. They would not be fallacious if the character or the actions of the person making the argument are directly related to the matter. That's the only way they would be valid. Unless the character or actions of the person making the argument are directly related to the matter, then criticizing the person and not their ideas is a fallacy. It's really an unfair thing to do. You're not stepping on fair ground when you do that. You're sort of cheating in a way, is the way I like to look at it. You're not really addressing the argument, you're just criticizing the person. This tactic is often used to undermine the opponent without engaging in the issue at hand. It's also used as a diversion tactic. We often see this in political smear campaigns. Instead of addressing the policy proposals of a rival candidate, one focuses on the rumors about their personal life. How many times have we seen this, especially with very recent political candidates, very recent persons who have held office? You know, very often they want to attack the person. They don't want to deal with the ideas. They just want to attack this other side because this other side is wrong, because they're a bad person, or they didn't file their tax returns, or they didn't do this, or they didn't do that. So lots of times you will find this in politics. But we also, unfortunately, are seeing it in science. Questioning the credentials of a scientist, dismissing a scientist's research about a vaccine injury, for instance, by saying that they're not a real scientist, rather than addressing the data. One of the things that I always found, or that I find problematic when I'm dealing with discussing vaccine issues and COVID-19 issues with people, is they always want to point to the double-blind gold standard study. But there's a lot of valid data that's been collected clinically that they just dismiss because it's not a double-blind study. You know, that's, some of this data is quite valid in the way that it's collected that you wouldn't get in a double-blind study. So it's worth examining. So that's some way, that's another way that the ad hominem attack is used. So how do we counter the ad hominem arguments? First, point out the irrelevance of the attack. Point out that the personal attack has nothing to do with the discussion at hand. And by calling out your opponent on their fallacious reasoning, you might go on the offensive and ask your opponent to justify why their personal attack is relevant to this discussion. You can respond to the attack directly. In some cases, you might want to fully address the ad hominem attack, even if it's fallacious, if it could affect the outcome of your discussion in some way. Or you could ignore the attack, just keep the discussion going while refusing to engage with the personal attack that your opponent made. Or you could do another variation of that, which is acknowledge the attack and move on. This is like ignoring the ad hominem attack, except that you first acknowledge it explicitly before moving on with the discussion. I think the first way is probably the best way, and the most direct way is just to point out the irrelevance of the attack. Point out that the personal attack has nothing to do with the discussion, and then ask them to justify why they think it's relevant to the discussion. A non sequitur. A non sequitur is an inference, statement, or conclusion that doesn't follow logically from the premise or the evidence. Non sequitur is Latin for "it does not follow." So we see this from time to time. They're actually kind of funny when I look at them. So here's an example of a non sequitur. All birds can fly. The premise number one, all birds can fly. Premise number two, penguins are birds. Conclusion, therefore penguins can juggle. It's really completely out of left field. It has nothing to do with the premises that were presented beforehand. So here the conclusion about penguins juggling is a non sequitur because it doesn't logically follow from the premises. While the premises talk about birds and penguins, the conclusion introduces an unrelated and unexpected idea, juggling, that has no logical basis in the given premises. Here's another example. All cats have fur, therefore it's going to rain tomorrow. It doesn't make any sense. So in this example, the conclusion about the weather, it's going to rain tomorrow, doesn't logically follow from the premise about cats having fur. The two statements are unrelated, making it a non sequitur. Non sequiturs can be intentional for comedic effect, but in logical reasoning and argumentation, they weaken the overall coherence and validity of the argument. They really detract from the argument that really could be made there. So how should we respond to a non sequitur? Clarify and redirect. Politely point out that the lack of connection between the statements. Ask for clarification to understand how the two points are related. Redirect the conversation back to the original topic or argument is another possibility. You could say, for example, I understand your point about whatever the non sequitur is, but I'm not sure how that relates to our discussion about the original topic. Could you help me understand the connection? It really puts them on the spot and forces them to think and forces them to give you an answer. It may or may not be a good answer, but it puts them on the spot and forces them to think and come up with something. So ways to respond to a non sequitur. We can request explanation. We can request further explanation for the leap in logic. We can encourage the person to provide more context or to bridge the gap between the statements. For example, I'm having trouble seeing how the non sequitur follows from what we're discussing. Could you help me understand the connection or provide more context? And you could focus on the original argument, reinforce the importance of addressing the original argument, and encourage a return to the main points of the discussion. For example, I think it's crucial for us to stay focused on the main issue we're discussing. Let's go back to the original point and explore that further. Hasty generalization fallacy. We make hasty generalizations when we draw conclusions based on insufficient evidence or a small sample size. Suppose we meet three rude New Yorkers and conclude that all New Yorkers are rude. In this case, we're making a sweeping statement based on limited encounters and a very small sample size. And this is really true. A lot of people have the assumption that New Yorkers are rude. And I've never been that way to people in New York. You know, I practiced law in New York for 19 years. My colleagues and friends and I, you know, we'd be on the subway on the way to court, and you could see the tourists. You know, they're in the subway, and they got all these maps, and they're trying to figure out, you know, like Magellan, trying to figure out where they're going. And we just simply smile and say to them, where are you going today? You know, what would you like to see today? How can we help you get there faster or maybe more efficiently? You know, a lot of us did that. A lot of New Yorkers I saw were like that. Very few were rude. But somehow New Yorkers have this bad reputation that we treat people badly in the subway or elsewhere, or they're in our way and we're in a hurry. No, that wasn't the experience that I had practicing law in New York for almost 20 years. We were very helpful to tourists anyway. So how do we confront the hasty generalization fallacy? Point out the hasty generalization. Clearly identify the generalization that's being made. Express your concern about the conclusion being drawn from limited or inadequate evidence. For example, you could say, it seems like you're making a generalization based on a small sample. Can we consider a more comprehensive view of the situation? And ask for specific examples. Request specific examples or evidence supporting the generalization. Encourage the person to provide more details to substantiate their claim. Example, I'm curious to hear more examples or details that led you to the conclusion. It would help me better understand your position or your perspective. Quite often, they might not be able to think of any. You know, they want to say something about something, and they'll produce one small example of it. But then when you press them further, they don't really have many more examples of that. They just want to complain about that one thing and make a generalization from that one thing and do a wider perspective. So this is a good way to confront the hasty generalization fallacy, I found. You could provide counterexamples. You could offer counterexamples that illustrate the diversity or exceptions to the generalization, highlight instances when the generalization doesn't hold true. For example, you could say, while I see your point, there are cases where the counterexample contradicts that generalization. It's important to consider the full range of solutions. You know, that will cause them to maybe think a little deeper on it, and cause them to see that they might be making a hasty generalization. You could highlight diversity or variability. Emphasize that the diversity or variability within the group or situation being generalized. Point out that the individual experiences or instances might differ. For example, you could say, it's essential to acknowledge the diversity within the group or situation. Making a generalization might overlook the variations that exist. So that's a good way to handle it as well. Making generalizations is not something that we want to do on a small sample size. We want to make generalizations over a good body of evidence, you know, something where you can make a fair generalization. So, do we have any questions?
Thank you very much, Sister Eva, for that presentation on critical thinking skills. And for those of you who are watching online, if you go to our website, villagesda.org, on the page for the Religious Liberty Week, we have your presentation posted there. And so people can download it for free, and they can take home examples of all these examples of critical thinking and how to respond in a thoughtful manner when we hear fallacious or incorrect assumptions or assertions coming our way. During the pandemic, this became a very important topic, critical thinking.
Very much so.
And I developed my own set of critical thinking questions, very similar to what you were sharing with us tonight. So I would look at somebody on the media and I'd ask myself these following four questions. Number one, has this source ever lied to me in the past?
very important.
Okay. If yes, if no, which was a rarity, then the next question was, is this person being paid to say what they're saying?
Also very important. Indicates bias.
It indicates bias. And then the next question is, would this person be fired if they said anything other than what they're saying now?
That's very
That was another good question.
Yeah.
And then the fourth question was, what has this person risked or sacrificed in order to share what they're saying with me now?
That is so important, because that, if you ask that, if you take a look at the doctors that you've seen in the media, and some that have been demonized or debanked, they've risked a lot. A lot of these doctors who came out to bring the truth, Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. Tenpenny, Dr. Bitar, you know, they risked a lot. They were called, I believe, the disinformation dozen in the beginning. And they risked a lot. They had a lot of criticism. Some lost their jobs and their careers. In the case of Dr. Peter McCullough, he was very well written and researched doctor. He had a stellar career and a stellar body of research that, you know, he'd brought together. And they dismissed him. They sued him. I mean, a lot of the doctors really suffered to bring forth the truth and to discuss alternative treatments to what the narrative was. Brought to you by Pfizer. How many times did we see that on CNN? I mean, that indicates bias right there.
And I realized as a Christian that if I ask all these questions about Jesus Christ, he passes the test on each four of these tests. He has never lied to me. He's not being paid to say what he did. He risked everything for me, and he died for what he said. And so I realized that Jesus passes all of these tests in a way that no earthly source of information ever can or will do.
Absolutely.
So we'd like to invite people to download the presentation and maybe use this at home if you're homeschooling or want to learn more about critical thinking. It's a great resource. But I'd like to ask you, Sister Tompkins, for people raising children, what do you have a helpful tip on how to nurture critical thinking skills among children?
Well, I think with kids, you know, there's so many games you can play to bring out, to make them think deeper about what they're being told or what they're being shown or what they're reading, you know? And kids have such a natural curiosity for things. It's very easy to just to tease that out and let them run with it, because they will run with it. They'll create all kinds of scenarios in their heads. Oh, yeah, I didn't think of that. You know, and then that's a way to encourage critical thinking, I think. The way my father encouraged critical thinking with me, we were always taught to question authority. You know, don't accept what you're being told at face value. You know, think about it. What do you think about it? Do you think that they're right? Do you think maybe they're not right? You know, so I was taught from a very young age to question authority, question what I was being told, and don't just accept it. You really think for yourself. And that skill is so important these days. No, you know, few people seem to have it, but it's so easy to instill in kids because they like to think. Kids want to think. You know, they want to come up with alternative scenarios. They want to come up with, and it can be a game, and they love games. So I think that's the way to do it, make a game out of it, make them think of other things. You know, well, what else could explain this? You know, what else could you think of? Where else have you seen this before? Or where haven't you seen it before? You know, you could ask questions like that, and they like to make a game out of it. They would really, I think that would be helpful to them. And that would encourage them to be young adults who critically think, which is desperately what we need. I mean, so many times these kids and their phones, they're not thinking. They're just taking in the information. Mm-hmm. And it's not even information. Most of it's foolishness, to be honest with you. A lot of the stuff on social media is just foolishness. So teaching them at a young age, they will carry that into their teen years, and then they'll carry that into their college age years, and then they'll carry it as young adults and grow up to be adults who don't take things at face value. I was talking with a friend the other day, and he said, why do people just accept things? When did that happen? Why do you think that happened? And I think it could have started in the 50s when TV came out. You know, when there was a TV in every household, people just glued to the TV and really didn't ask questions about it. They also trusted doctors like they were God. I had a grandmother who was a registered nurse, and she wasn't fond of doctors because she saw them do not so nice things. So as a nurse, she really had to distrust for doctors, but patients didn't. Patients thought of doctors as if they were God. Many people still do, when they could be thinking, well, how else could I attack this health problem that I'm having? Is there another way? Like these doctors that have been criticized unfairly, you know, they, from the beginning, we're looking at other drugs that we've used before and possibly repurposing them. Dr. Stella Emanuel, she was looking at that from the beginning. How do we repurpose these drugs that we know have worked for other things? It was known before, even the NIH knew, that hydroxychloroquine was used with SARS-2, and they knew that was an effective treatment for that, and they buried that.
So one of the things I found helpful in my experience of life is I always want to read the source document. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody says, oh, that's a cultural Marxist view or that's a Christian nationalist view, I want to go and read the original book, the original ideas for myself, because oftentimes people misrepresent it for the argument they're making. And if I want to know what Karl Marx said, or if I want to know what Jesus Christ says, or if I want to know what any of these historical figures say, I want to read the original words myself. And then I can come to my own conclusion without it being filtered through somebody else's biases and prejudices and the argument they want me to accept it.
Absolutely.
And so in my reading as a missionary and my role with Adventist Frontier Missions, I read a wide variety of non-Christian literature because I want to know where somebody's coming from, because oftentimes they are dealing with a legitimate issue just from a non-biblical perspective. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people from a secular perspective, they're trying with the best of intent to fix a problem without realizing that the only solution comes when we come together in Jesus Christ and say, what would God wish for this situation here? So I'd like to say thank you, Sister Tompkins, for your presentation tonight. We'd like to remind everybody watching this that you can download this presentation from the Village Church website. And your presentation for tomorrow, which is on CBDCs, mm-hmm. Central Bank Digital Currencies, how they work, and their direct impact on religious liberty and liberty of conscience. That presentation is a very detailed, it's a technical presentation that is already on the website, and we encourage people to download it and read it for yourselves. This is a valuable resource to help prepare for what we know is the onset ultimately of the mark of the beast and the no buy, no sell rules of Revelation chapter 13.
Yes.
So Sister Tompkins, it's been a pleasure having you with us this evening.
Thank you
and we
so
look
much.
Forward to your presentation tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.